for the two. And are you dividing the time? Or?
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
How are you dividing it?
I will be addressing, on behalf of both Mr. Leonis-Guerres and Mr. Stevens, only the challenge to the substance abuse testing provision, and Ms. Fontier will be addressing only the challenge to the substance abuse treatment provision.
Only the... You kept co-counsel suggesting what I could not hear. Yeah.
The substance abuse treatment condition, specifically the argument that the district court in both of our cases improperly delegated the authority to determine whether our clients must undergo substance abuse treatment as part of supervised release. I will be addressing the testing condition.
Okay. Do you want to proceed?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Lori Schoenberg of the Federal Defenders of San Diego, on behalf of the defendant appellant in this case, Ramiro Leonis-Sparza. With me is Alice Fontier from my office, counsel for defendant appellant Antonio Damon Stevens. Turning to the substance abuse testing condition, in this case, the text of the supervised release statute, 18 U.S.C. section 3583D, expressly vests the authority to set the maximum number of drug tests required as part of supervised release with the district court and not with the probation officer. The statute says, quote, "The court shall also order, as an explicit condition of supervised release, that the defendant refrain from any unlawful use of a controlled substance and submit to a drug test within 15 days of release on supervised release, and at least two periodic tests thereafter, paren, as determined by the court, and paren, for use of a controlled substance, unless the condition is, quote, ameliorated or suspended by the court. In no way did Congress intend, and does the language of the statute allow, that the court can delegate that authority to a non-judicial officer like probation. By requiring that Mr. Leonis-Sparza and Mr. Stevens, quote, submit to one drug test within 15 days of release from imprisonment and at least two periodic drug tests thereafter as directed by the probation officer, and as special conditions of supervised release, quote, participate in a program or of drug or alcohol abuse treatment, including urinalysis testing and counseling as directed by the probation officer, the district court violated both the supervised release statute and Article 3 by allowing the probation officer and not itself to determine whether Mr. Leonis-Sparza and Mr. Stevens must undergo substance abuse testing as part of supervised release and the maximum number of drug tests to be performed beyond the minimum of three mandated by Congress.
Well, there are two different problems, and I thought you were dividing them. One is whether the court delegated to the probation officer the decision as to whether your clients had to undergo drug treatment program.
I'm only addressing the testing provision in this case.
Then, as to the testing provisions, what's wrong with the solution the First Circuit found in, was it Lewandowski, which is to construe that provision as saying the court only ordered three, and that's all that can be given outside of a treatment program?
That's fine, Your Honor. We would not have a problem with that solution if this court chose to avoid the improper delegation problem, as the First Circuit did in that case. We would say, though, that the standard and special conditions in this case were not ambiguous in terms of delegating the authority of whether to submit someone to testing to the probation officer and also the maximum number of tests required. The First Circuit in Padilla did distinguish Lewandowski on that basis and just invalidated the conditions in that case, but we're fine.
But the panel in Padilla added some separate opinions to it, and two out of the three judges in Padilla seemed to say, we're not very happy about where we are, but we are bound by existing First Circuit precedent.
Yes, the First Circuit in Padilla did say that they were bound by the ruling in Melendez-Santana, which said that the plain language of 3583D gave the courts the responsibility to determine the maximum number of drug tests beyond three that would be required, and also went on to say that courts cannot fulfill this congressionally assigned responsibility by assigning it to probation officers. The source of the dispute in Padilla was whether the plain error doctrine should apply.
Which is a problem, I think, for you in this case, isn't it?
It's a problem for me, not a problem for Mr. Stevens, because they did raise it below. I respectfully disagree with Judge Scalia's opinion in that case. And
wouldn't everybody like to get it clear? I mean, we're talking about a form that is used, and it's a problem that's not very difficult to solve, either for the past or the future.
No, not at all.
I would think both sides would want to have a nice, clear answer about how the form should read.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and all the court has to do, all the district courts have to do in these cases to solve the improper delegation problem is just to make clear that they are ordering a defendant to submit to substance abuse testing as part of supervised release and just set a maximum number of drug tests that would be required during that term. That's all.
Can you say 100?
You could say 100.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out the practical impact here. I mean, is it going to be that, because what happens, as I understand it, is you have an ongoing testing and treatment together,
right,
and when you get indications or where the as so-called delegated here, where the probation officer has reason to suspect that maybe the test is going to turn out positive because he's been associated with the wrong people or he's gotten these other reports, orders a test. Now, under your scheme, do we have either A, the district court setting a high maximum, so basically have exactly what you have now, except you got a high ceiling there someplace, or B, everybody rushing back to the court to get permission to have an additional test based on factual circumstances that arise in the course of probation? I don't see how either of those really advance the game at all, but are those the alternatives we're facing?
Those could be the alternatives you're facing. What could happen is that the district court could set a certain number of drug tests that would occur, and if it appears that the defendant in question is in violation, the probation officer can go back to the court and say, look,
this is all you really need is the district court has to say to the probation office, what's the maximum number of tests you would reasonably ever impose? One a week? If let's say the probation officer says, yes, one a week. Then the district court, then the form from then on reads that the drug test shall be conducted at the discretion of the probation office, but not more than one a week. And that would be the form. It solves whatever legal problem would exist if Congress required that the court determine the number. I think Judge Clifton says it doesn't really solve any practical problem. It solves a legal problem because there's no delegation then.
There would be no delegation in that case. The use of the term at the discretion of the probation officer, I would think, would be problematic because the term discretion could imply that the probation officer can decide whether to submit someone to substance abuse testing, but in all other respects...
Well, he doesn't have to. I mean, if the court says you may test, but not more than once a week,
right,
the probation office can determine whether to give a test each week. They don't have to if he's doing well.
Plus the fact, counsel, that the person who's on this program reports to the probation office on a regular basis, either once a month or twice a month, and they get a chance to see these people, and they determine whether these people are doing what they're supposed to do. And I don't think that you contemplate that these people on this program would report to a judge once a month or twice a month on that basis. They see these people regularly, and they are trained to know what to look for when they see them. And many times they find that even these people say that they're doing these things, turns out they're not, and they have learned ways to get around it. We're not dealing with people who are unsophisticated in handling this matter, and you have to have people who are somewhat sophisticated to see it and report back to the judge, because certainly the defendant isn't going to do that. He's going to try to get around this system if he possibly can.
Certainly, the probation officer can make recommendations to the district court, and the district court can solicit recommendations. I'm not saying that there should be no interaction between the probation officer and the district court. It's just that in this case, 3583D expressly vests the authority to impose substance abuse testing conditions with the court and not the probation officer, and to do otherwise would be an improper delegation of power. Now, unless this court has any other questions, I'd like to turn this matter over to Ms. Fontier. Thank you.
Thank you. And, Your Honor, just as a
preliminary note, I will note the difference between Mr. Stevens and Mr. Leon Esparza is that at the sentencing in this matter, Mr. Stevens did object to the drug testing conditions. Secondly, Mr. Stevens, this issue is right before the court because Mr. Stevens has been released from custody and is currently on supervised release. He has been since June of last year, and he did undergo treatment, and is currently subjected to continuous testing. That's the only difference between Mr. Stevens and Mr. Leon Esparza, however. Now, as to the drug treatment condition, again, Your Honors, the language of the condition is what we take issue with. The language of that condition...
So let me ask you a question. Let's assume that the language made it clear that the judge determined whether your client would be subjected to a drug treatment program, not the probation officer. If that were true, do you have any problem with the fact that once he goes into a treatment program, that then the number of drug tests can be determined by the people administering the program?
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay.
However,
so the only issue you have is whether under this language it's the court or the probation officer that made the decision as to whether he went into the program.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
And again, just to clarify the testing it under the guise of treatment, however, I believe that the language of the condition would have to basically say the defendant shall undergo drug treatment. During the course of treatment, the defendant may be subjected to urinalysis testing or drug testing of whatever nature.
Doesn't it basically say that he will undergo treatment including urinalysis? That's what I seem to remember.
It says that's what it says. It says the undergo drug treatment including urinalysis testing at the discretion of the probation office. The what I have issue with is that the language, the at the discretion of the probation office, modifies the treatment condition, and it's not clear from the language of the condition whether or not the defendants in these cases would have to undergo drug treatment. The ultimate decision as to whether or not the person enters treatment is left to the probation office. I believe that condition, the problem is compounded by the fact of the condition, the drug testing condition, which Ms. Schoenberg addressed, in that drug testing occurs from the day a person is put on supervised release, whether or not they're subjected to treatment. During the course of treatment, I do not object to the person undergoing drug testing and the number to be determined by.
The condition reads, is it certain that he shall participate in a program of drug or alcohol abuse treatment, including your urinalysis testing and counseling, as directed by the probation officer. That's the condition we're talking about?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, why shouldn't that be read as requiring that he participate in a program of alcohol or drug abuse treatment?
Yeah.
And that the probation officer administers that, but that the decision has been made that he must participate in a program.
Yeah, I don't believe that the language is clear, and because of that, to support my argument
clear,
for that, I would turn the court's attention
if
to...
If it's not clear, why can't we construe it that way if it's ambiguous?
I believe that the problem is that it can be construed either way.
Is that bad for your client? One thing that puzzles me here is that I read it like Judge Reinhardt did, that the treatment program is directed by the judge. The judge says you're in a program, and the details of the program, that goes to the probation officer. Now, you're suggesting the possibility is there the probation officer says no program's required at all. Well, I flip it around. Is that bad for your client? For the probation officer to say, well, you don't have to bother with the program, you're clean, I'm satisfied, get out of here.
That, in effect, would of course not be bad for my client. However, the problem is that the language on its face is ambiguous. It can be read in either direction. And the probation, for exactly the reason you stated, under the language of this condition, the probation officer can say, no, you don't have to go to treatment, or yes, you do have to go to treatment. It's simply a legal issue that the court cannot delegate that decision to the probation office.
You want us to read it the other way, then?
Then
it would be legal.
No, Your Honor. What I would like you to do is follow the rule that the Second Circuit set in United States v. Peterson, which says, because of the ambiguity in the language, that there are two possible readings, that it must be reversed.
Counsel, what does your client suffer by being monitored by somebody on a regular basis to see that he's doing what he's supposed to do? That's how he got to the court in the first place.
How
does he suffer by that?
The problem, Your Honor, is that he has to undergo treatment or testing on a weekly basis. He's been on supervised release for over 6 months.
Well, this is somebody they just picked off the street and picked up for this program. This is somebody who's violated the law. And instead of going to jail, that they're giving him this treatment on an outpatient basis.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The judge could have sent him to jail, and they would monitor him in jail.
Your Honor, the problem is that it's I'm not arguing as to the applicability of this condition. There's no.
Educate me. What is it you're suffering that you want us to correct?
That it's an improper delegation. It's a simply a legal issue. I'm not arguing as to the applicability of this of the condition.
You've got a client here. I mean, I think we're all puzzled by the same thing. You've got a client here, and I can't figure out how your client's interests are being furthered by a position that seems to say, you've got to make my client do something, rather than give the probation officer the possibility of saying you don't have to do it.
Well, Your Honor, the problem is that there's simply no meaningful judicial review of the terms of the supervised release, and we don't know what happens to each and every defendant until after a revocation has happened, and then the person has to challenge the revocation.
But these people are addicted. They're addicted, and they're trying to get them off of that addiction.
Your Honor,
purposes. Otherwise, why do it?
Especially in Mr. Leon's case, there's simply no indication of that on the record. And
why would they send them to the program then? Do you think they just pick them out and send them to the program?
The problem is, Your Honor, that they have complete unfettered discretion to make these decisions.
No, no. But wasn't he found using some of the substance?
In Mr. Stevens' case, yes, he was.
Well, so they take somebody who's using the substance, they're trying to get him off of it. And instead of putting him in jail, they let him go back to work so he can have some kind of a meaningful life, and they're going to treat him. And their government is paying for him to be treated. Now, what is he suffering by that?
Again, Your Honor, I am not challenging the applicability of this condition to Mr. Stevens. If the condition had been properly worded, I would not be before Your Honors arguing that the court could not determine the test.
What was I doing for this human being? Because what happens to these people, if they don't get, you read about them in the newspaper being found dead on the street.
I'm not arguing that that Mr. Stevens or any other defendant is not allowed to be drug tested. Whether or not he undergoes treatment and the number of tests simply has to be decided by the court.
Somebody has to monitor him on a regular basis. You don't expect the judge to monitor him on a weekly basis, do you?
I don't, Your Honor. I simply ask them to set a range or a maximum number of tests and make the ultimate decision as to whether or not the person goes into treatment.
In other words, the people that are testing will tell you that he's making progress. Most of these people don't do well on that program. Very few of them actually succeed.
Your Honor, the probation officer has absolute authority to monitor the test. That is the probation officer's job, and then to report to the court. We're simply asking the court to make the ultimate decisions as to the conditions of the sentence and the supervised release.
Suppose the court doesn't make the decision and this person is still addicted. How does he suffer by that?
At that point, Your Honor, if the probation officer felt that it was necessary, they may come into court and ask for a modification of the supervised release condition.
Why have another hearing when it's not necessary?
The problem is, Your Honor, that this it absolutely gives the probation officer unfettered discretion to do as they wish. And that was, on the plain language of the statute, that was clearly not Congress's intent. The statute says that it has to be determined by the court.
Trained in this area? Have been doing it all the time? They look at people who are addicted. They see them all the time. They're there in court when these people plead guilty. They're there in court when they're sentenced. And they take on the burden of monitoring these people on a regular basis.
Your Honor, the probation office has the power to make recommendations to the court, and the court may then institute the appropriate sentence. If that sentence turns out to not be appropriate, the probation office can come back and ask for modification. It's just the language of the statute states clearly that it's a decision to be made by the court. It was Congress's intent, and we simply are asking the court to follow the language of the statute.
But we're talking about somebody who's been convicted of a crime who's using drugs. Isn't that correct?
Not in every case, Your Honor.
That's how they got there, right? That's how they got before the court. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, the fact is that they're convicted,
they
are convicted.
And the court is extending treatment to these people, which they don't pay for. The government pays for it. The citizens pay for that. Now, what harm do they suffer if somebody monitors this on a regular basis?
No, Your Honor, I think exactly what you just said is my point, that if the court gives them treatment, I would not be standing here today. The problem is that the court gives the probation officer the discretion.
Who do you think the probation officer, and who do they work for?
They're non-judicial officers, however, and giving them the authority to make
the court.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You don't expect a judge to take this man over every week and make sure he gets a treatment, do you?
I don't. That's not what I'm asking for, Your Honor.
Well, the person who monitors it is a probation officer. He sees these people on a regular basis, and many of them don't even show up for those appointments.
Monitoring is well within the power of the probation office as an appointee of the court. That is absolutely true. However, making the decision as to the conditions of supervised release, making the decisions as to what the person's sentence will be.
You think going there that have been cured? You think probation officers keep sending people back to take the treatments when they don't need them?
Your Honor, I can't say what probation officers do in every single case.
I can't say it because we do it on a regular basis, and we monitor these people on a regular basis.
I know that Mr. Stevens has been tested every week for 6 months and is yet to test positive and still continues to be tested.
Is he cured?
Perhaps maybe he is. I don't know.
Perhaps. You don't know.
I can't speak to Mr. Stevens' drug condition.
But the probation officer could answer that question in 2 seconds. Because he would know what the reports show, and he would also notice that maybe he didn't show up each week, or maybe they hasn't returned, or maybe he's involved in another crime or has been rearrested.
If that were true, there would be a revocation hearing, and that's not the case.
Right.
Mr. Stevens has been complying with the conditions of supervised release. The only problem before the court is that we don't know what those conditions are, and there's absolutely no judicial review as to those conditions.
And
we're asking the court.
Doesn't know that either. You think the probation officer is ignorant of all that?
No, I'm sure the probation officer knows it. The problem is that the court doesn't know, and Congress gave that power to the court.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Carol Lee on behalf of the United States Respondent Appellee. On the Stevens matter, and with me at counsel's table is Jason Oda, who is here for Respondent Pelley on the Leon Esparza matter. In listening to argument just now, the problem here is that appellant is raising the issue as to whether probation has the authority to conduct further testing. That's really the issue, but the issue is framed by appellant in the briefs, and as it has evolved, that's what it's become. But the issue...
I understand there are two separate issues before us. One is whether the treatment program has been ordered by the court, or whether the court left it up to the probation officer to decide whether there should be a treatment program. If we were to construe the provision as saying the court has determined that there shall be a treatment program and that the probation officer administers that program, then there's no dispute. Now, do you agree that that's the proper interpretation?
Well, I think the appellant's argument is challenging Judge Lorenz's order. And so we need to review Judge's order. The analysis starts with Judge Lorenz.
All you need to do is answer my question. We don't need to review the order. The question was the condition in the order that says that the defendant shall participate in a drug and alcohol treatment program. Does that constitute a determination by the judge that the defendant shall participate in a program? Or does it mean that the judge has said to the probation officer, you make the determination whether the defendant shall enter a program?
No, it does say that treatment is mandatory per the court.
Your opponents say that if that's what it means, there's no issue. Now, they said that it's ambiguous, and that the Second Circuit said that if it's ambiguous, that means it's unlawful. Our question is, can we say that the condition means that? If we do, there's no more issue as to that part of the case. The other part of the case is the court required to set a maximum number of times outside of treatment that the probation officer can require drug testing? They're not contesting that when he's in treatment, can be any number of times. They're saying that when there's no treatment program, the court must specify the maximum number of treatments. Now, the First Circuit said that when you have the standard condition of the 1 in 15 days and then at least 2 more, that if that's all the court says, they will construe that as a maximum of three, and that if you want more, you go back to the court and get the order changed. What's your position on that?
Well, let me address first the treatment issue. Here, the order is explicit. Treatment is mandatory. There's no improper delegation. And Judge Lorenz directed that the ministerial, the administrative functions of monitoring those tests would be conducted by probation. That's what's delegated here, and that's proper, and that's within line of Article 3 of the guidelines and the statute. If in the worst-case scenario, as Your Honor referred to in the Second Circuit, the Peterson case, that it would be remanded to Judge Lorenz to somehow remand this treatment provision to clarify what he meant,
What we really want to do, look, this is a standard form, I think probably not only here, but probably elsewhere. So we don't want to remand it and have him make a special finding in that particular case. You want to end up with a form that you can use where you don't have to litigate every single case. And if we were to construe the form, as you suggest, as being a direction by the court that the defendants participate in these programs, then there's no further legal problem. Now, if we didn't construe it that way and said it was an invalid provision, then you'd just have to rewrite the provision. But let's assume for the moment that that problem is solved, that we would construe it the way you do. What about the other provision where the number of out-of-treatment tests Congress said is directed by the court? Do you agree that the court has to set the number?
No, not the maximum number. I do agree that the minimum number must be set, that that's required by statute. And the minimum number is three. And here the court did do that. It explicitly, in the testing provision,
you believe
referred
that the court
to three.
Can say, and you must give three and as many others as the probation office determines?
The court can do that, but what it did here was just ordered the three, the minimum of three. Probation can test more, but that's pursuant to its historical authority, to statutory precedent here in the Ninth Circuit under United States versus Duff. The probation office can test further beyond the minimum three that the court orders. What the statute allows.
This is Duff after the statute?
It was, but that doesn't invalidate Duff. Presumably, Congress is aware of the Duff decision at the time that it amended the Violent Crimes and Law Enforcement Violent Crimes Control Act in 1994. Nevertheless, what the statute allows the court to do is to increase that minimum number. So the probation office can be ordered to test higher than just three. The minimum number can be increased to eight, maybe ten tests.
Do you think the First Circuit's just dead wrong?
Well, I do part ways with the First Circuit in its analysis of the...
You part ways, but you don't think they're wrong.
They are wrong. They are wrong. They are wrong because and the rub in the First Circuit was really with the oral order. There seems to be a discrepancy between the oral and the written order in the Melendez case as to when tests are conducted. But still have to focus on the broader authority here of probation. And probation does have the authority to conduct further testing. That's just part of its administrative duties that's properly delegated to it by the court. The as determined by the court language, I know that the appellant focuses in their arguments and in their briefs on this small subpart of the statute that the as determined by the court somehow delegates that the court must set a maximum number of tests to be conducted. But I'd argue that it refers to at least a certain number of tests. It doesn't suggest that Congress meant there should be a maximum number of tests. It suggests three tests. It doesn't require any more than what the statute says.
If you point to a different statute, inciting Duff and I presume Reardon, to say that the probation office itself has authority beyond what the statute we're talking about here, which speaks of the court, I got that kind of backwards. But you're pointing to a separate statute to give the probation office the authority to go higher than the whatever minimum is ordered by the court under the statute that makes reference to the court.
Correct. Under Title 18, United States Code, I believe Section 3603, which delegates duties to the probation office. I mean, Duff is still good law. It is from 1987. And the statute, the amendment to the statute didn't change that. But the amendment did come up after Duff, and there was no question that it was intended to change the statute. But historically, you still have to look at the statute, at the legislative intent of Congress, which at the time that the amendment was created was an attempt to address concern that there wasn't enough testing being done, that actually there was under-testing was becoming a recurrent problem. And because of this, Congress set that there should be a minimum number of tests that the court should order probation to conduct. Just because it came later than Duff doesn't mean that it overturned Duff. I point out to the court that we still have the focus. It should be on the language of the district court's order here. And the district court's order tracks the statute almost verbatim. It's not impermissibly delegating any authority to the probation office. Our testing provision just simply tells probation to carry out the administrative duties that are necessary to monitor defendants, which is quite different from the Melendez case, where the Melendez case there was an express delegation of authority to the probation office, and that's improper. And again, as to the treatment conditions, the language of our order is much different than the Melendez case, because again, the Melendez order clearly delegated the decision whether the defendant gets treatment to the probation office, and again, that is improper. With that, Your Honors, I'd like to defer to my counsel on the Leon Esparza matter, unless the court has any further questions.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jason Oates on behalf of the United States. Your Honor's framed, there were two issues in this case, and I'd like to incorporate Ms. Lee's arguments on behalf of the United States in reference to Leon Esparza. Because I have a short time frame, I just like to...
Is the order different?
No.
So it's all the same thing?
It's
you don't have to speak separately for the second case. The order is the same.
The orders are the same, Your Honor.
My impression. And why we put the two cases together.
That's what I thought. And just in case this court, at least on issue number two that Judge Reinhardt was talking about setting the maximum amount of drug tests, just in case Your Honors find that the court must do that, and there wasn't, improper delegation here under the plain error of review, which is the only differences in our case is that the Leon Esparza matter is a plain error standard. And I think by the questions...
Well, what good does it do your office to get a decision in one case that it's okay because it's plain error and in the other that it's not all right because it was raised?
I mean, Your Honor, I agree that the legal issue could be raised in the Stevens case, at least for the government's point of view. A good plain error analysis of just was there an error? Maybe. Was it plain? No, because there's not a clear deviation of the law.
You would say that even if we decide Stevens against you, we should decide Esparza in your favor. Is that your point?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what good does that do anybody?
Just under the plain error analysis,
maybe it wouldn't urge us to revisit a lot of cases where there's not a practical difference, but we can make a statement of law in a case where plain error isn't at issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the practical reasons, you're right, for our office, it wouldn't make a difference because we'd still be at square one.
For practical, for your office, what you think we ought to do about it. Your first position is, say, that the probation office can determine any number. The court just decides the minimum, and from then on, the probation officer has full range to decide whatever number he wants.
That's correct, Your Honor.
If you were to lose on that point, what's your next choice? How do you feel about the First Circuit solution of saying that the order is valid, but you construe it as limited to three unless it's amended by the court?
Assuming that we lose on that point. And it's difficult to, like, what I find practical and what the United States find practical may be two differing things. And I believe that that would be correct, assuming that you find an error, that the minimum of three as a mandatory condition would be the number of drug tests out of treatment.
Out of treatment.
Out of treatment. And then, as you framed it, the special condition that while they're in treatment at the discretion of probation, that...
That's that
exactly. As long as the court, because I think that's
so
the issue.
The court makes the order. Right?
Exactly. Which
you construe the condition as the court having made that order.
Absolutely.
Right. All right. I think we understand that. Okay. So your purpose of your argument is to say, whatever you do about Stevens, don't do it in this case also, because it's plain error.
Yes, and I agree with counsel.
And otherwise you adopt your co-counsel's arguments.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Unless somebody's got 1 minute worth of rebuttal, we're through. Is it? No? No.
I think you have 1 minute, just briefly.
First of all, Ms. Lee, in the Stevens case, did refer to the language of 3583 and said that that only requires a minimum number of tests that the court must impose as opposed to a maximum. And what I would say is that that condition could not be, that statute could not be more plain. What it does say in 3583G is that after the first drug test within 15 days of release, the court must impose at least two periodic tests thereafter, paren, as determined by the court. I think we have to go with what the statute says. The statute means what it says, and that is what Congress intended.
But could the probation office have authority to order additional testing under a different statute, as we held in Duff?
No, Your Honor, because in that, no, because the 1984 and 1994 acts actually narrowed probation officers' authority to do so. The statute at issue in Duff, 18 U.S.C. section 3655, was actually replaced by the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. Footnote 1 in Duff actually acknowledges that. The Sentencing Reform Act require that, quote, the court may order as a further condition of supervised release any condition set forth as a discretionary condition of probation in section 3563, including requirements that a defendant undergo available medical, psychiatric, or psychological treatment, including treatment for drug or alcohol dependency, as specified by the court. In the 1984 statute, Congress required that a probation officer use all suitable methods to aid a probationer or a person on supervised release. Now, in 1994, Congress amended 3583D to vest the authority to determine the maximum number of drug tests with the court. And in that same statute, Congress amended the provisions, the general provisions regarding the duties of probation officers by specifying that, quote, the chief probation officer shall arrange for the drug testing of defendants on post-conviction release pursuant to a conviction for a felony or other offense. The First Circuit in Melendez-Santana construed that as giving the probation officer the authority to set up a testing program. And the difference between the 1984 and the 1994 Act, I would submit, narrows the probation officer's authority and clarifies that Congress intended that the probation officer support the court by providing ministerial support services, such as establishing a program, not to decide whether either client must undergo substance abuse testing or treatment as part of supervised release. Finally, just with regard to jurisdictional error, I did want to make clear that courts, when examining an improper delegation of judicial authority, typically do not decide whether the error is prejudicial and automatically reverse. Melendez-Santana and Padilla did that in the First Circuit by saying that the error at issue, the improper delegation of judicial authority for the testing, was not subject to, quote-unquote, the usual plain error review. And the Supreme Court, in Wynn versus United States, a 2003 Supreme Court case, essentially followed that analysis as well. In that case, that dealt with an improperly constituted Ninth Circuit panel consisting of an Article IV judge and two Article III judges. The Supreme Court in that case said that that was an improperly constituted appellate panel and declined the government's invitation to actually review that issue for plain error, stating that that invitation was inappropriate and, quote, to ignore the violation of the designation statute in these cases would incorrectly suggest that some action or inaction on the petitioner's part would create authority that Congress has quite carefully withheld. Even if the parties had expressly stipulated to the participation of a non-Article III judge in the consideration of their appeals, such a stipulation would not have cured the plain defect in the composition of the panel. Here, since this case involves an improper delegation of judicial authority, I believe this Court should treat it the same way as an error that is reversible, regardless of whether it is prejudicial or not. And with that, we will submit.
Thank you, counsel. Cases just argued will be submitted. The next case for oral argument is United States versus Anaya.